Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
It's a fairy tale for grown-ups. Is the way right. That's why I think it is a good way to describe it. You
know? It is. It is. I mean, it's got such the child, like the innocence of childhood. But then there's so many dark parts of this movie. Which my first question to you is, which guy are you?
Both.
Both.
I mean, both in the sense that I am aware of the brutal side of the world, but I am. A guy that loves to dream and imagine and so forth. I mean, I'm not by any far involved in heinous fascist torture and activities, but I am aware that there is a very dark side to the world and that one of the best ways to cope with it is fantasy.
Hi, I'm Dan.
And I'm Mike.
So welcome back to 15-Minute Film Fanatics. This is the podcast where Mike and I, two lifelong friends, watch movies separately, then don't talk about them until we hear on the podcast. What movie are we doing today, Mike?
Pan's Labyrinth.
Pan's Labyrinth, 2006, written and directed by Guillermo del Toro, actually titled El Labirinto del Fauno, The Labyrinth of the Faun. In part one, we always talk about our overall take on the film. Mike, what's yours?
I think that this movie captures the beauty and the charm of actual fairy tales, that there is something fabulous about this movie that I don't really see in any of Del Toro's other work. He's made some other movies that I think are okay, but this is just an amazing breakthrough, once in a generation film that is enchanting from beginning to end. It works like real art, and the spell is not broken until the final credits come up, and all of a sudden it just drops you back into reality. I find you can almost smell this movie, like when she's walking around in the woods. And I know that a lot of time, attention, and effort were put into the so-called special effects, which are of course all practical effects. Mm-hmm. We've said on the podcast about Tom Cruise and others that there are certain people that still believe in movie magic. And I would put Del Toro in the kind of pantheon of people that believe in movie magic, which is, I think, why this movie is able to do the things that it does to me as a viewer. I know you saw it for the first time, so I'm curious about your, you know, I've seen it, I don't know, 13, 14 times. What are your impressions of seeing this movie for the first time?
This is one of those movies that you have on your shelf and you're embarrassed to admit you haven't gotten around to seeing yet. And finally, I just said, I've got to see this movie. It's so great to see a movie that everybody has been praising forever, and it really is that good. Like, how often has that happened? You almost keep looking for the letdown.
Almost never. But this is everything people say about it and more.
Everything they say about it and more. So a couple points you just raised. This movie takes fairy tales seriously. In a fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm or Hans Christian Andersen, when something's supposed to be scary, you read, and then she was afraid. But in this movie, she really is afraid, and it does take that seriously. It takes childhood seriously. I mean, is there a better metaphor for what it's like to be a child than you are in a maze and people are telling you what to do and you can't figure out which way to go? That is the perfect metaphor for childhood. there was a lot of controversy over this because it looks like a Narnia movie, right? With the way it was, the way the poster looked. People are bringing their little kids to see this, and then they have the guy with the eyes in his hands, and they get freaked out. Now, of course, you wouldn't bring a five-year-old to see this unless you wanted to, like, traumatize the kid. But you could bring, like, a pretty hip, reasonably smart, like, 10-year-old to see this and let it be scary, but it would be scary, like, in a good way, because the thrills and the frights of it, I think, are, at least in the fairy tale parts, maybe we could talk about the Spanish Civil War parts later, but the fairy tale parts are certainly thrilling in a way that, like, that the writers of fairy tales want them to be. Like, it really is scary. Like, when the fawn comes in her room, like, it's really scary. When she meets, you know, the pale man, it's really scary. And I think it does those things really well. The other thing that's cool about this movie is it's so strange. And I don't mean it's strange because, you know, it's about a little girl who has to get, like, a key out of a toad's stomach. It's strange because it's amazing this movie was ever made at all or had the money to be made at all, right? Because it's like part Narnia, but it's part political. It's got adventure stuff. It's got horror. Like, you get the pale man scene, but then you get the scene in the woods with the rebels when that becomes like a commando movie, and you get the reality of the fallout of the Spanish Civil War. But then there's a piece of chalk that helps you make a door, like Wile E. Coyote, you know, into a wall or something like that. And it's really difficult to classify.
One of my problems with Del Toro's other movies is that they're very on the nose, to the point of being almost allegorical. With one-to-one correlations between things. And I think that what makes Pan's Labyrinth different from them and better is there's kind of like a one-to-many relationship, so that there's so many things going on. It's layered, not just in the psychological sense, it's layered in the sense that conflict or trying to find means Spanish identity and the Civil War, and yourself in a new family and a new arrival, and literally a new arrival to a different place, which is the spiritual realm that she's able to access in the movie. And I think that with only one or two dimensions, like some of his other films, it's almost cute. The substitution is too easy. It's just this for that. But here it's so easy to get lost in the complexity, but they do a brilliant job of course making it simple, right? Your job in life is to get the key out of the toad's belly. And so it's both complex in a way that's not understood, but simple in a way that's easy to follow, which is I think why you could take a hip 10-year-old to this movie and get away with it. Though, as you said, it's definitely not Narnia, Narnia is allegorical in an interesting way. We can talk about Narnia another time, but that's what this is not. This is not a one-to-one. The fawn is not one thing. The fawn is many things.
And that's why I think that the Narnia books as a whole are like that, like Aslan and Narnia, not to go off on another podcast here, but Aslan and Narnia is Christ-like. He's not just Christ in the books, right? And the film that most reminded me of that, how this is not just a one-to-one cute on-the-nose thing. What movie did we do that this movie is a perfect double feature with?
Spirited Away.
Yes, you win. You win the car. Exactly. It's just like Spirited Away, right? A young girl finds out that there's this realm right underneath this mystical realm, right underneath reality. And that realm is strange and it's frightening. And she has to do tasks in it and try to figure out how to coordinate these two realms. But it's not like the realm in Spirited Away isn't just a one-to-one thing. Like this means this and that means that.
Because allegory is written and meant to be understood.
Correct.
But what this movie is doing is using allegorical or metaphorical concepts to not to explain that which cannot be explained, but simply to draw it. This is right. Not an explanation of childhood or Spanish identity. This is a drawing of them.
Yes.
Both at the same time.
Yes, an allegory, like you just said, if you don't see the one-to-one correspondence, then the allegory, the writer of the allegory has failed, right? This is not Pilgrim's Progress. So welcome back to our conversation about Pan's Labyrinth. In part two, we like to talk about our favorite moments or things that stood out to us upon this viewing. Mike, what's yours?
My moment is right in the beginning when Ophelia is first touring the little ruins in the woods outside the compound where they're going to live. And she sees that weird statue made of stone. She looks on the ground. She sees that it's only got one eye. It's got one eye open and the other is missing. and she replaces the other eye where it should be, which is what sends that little fairy out of its mouth and kind of kicks everything off. And I think that is metaphorically on the nose, as in one of the things about children is they see the world without expectation, which means both eyes open. That's why they can see things that adults can't see, because they don't assume that they know what things mean. They're in the receptive mode. They're there to take things in because they don't know what anything means, which is why they pick up stuff that we miss or assume is unimportant. If you look at the stone, it just looks like a stone. But if you see that the statue is missing an eye, that's when you enter into another place. I think also what struck me about that moment and continues to strike me on rewatching is this movie seems to know that there are some people that will not like this movie. And because they're watching the wrong way, it's almost like a taunt to the viewer that says, we're going to show you something special and we're going to show you something beautiful if you have eyes to see it. But if you don't have eyes to see it, this movie's just going to look totally weird to you. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people that expected Narnia or expected some other kind of ending or expected some other kind of structure that are sitting in the theater going, what is this? And it's because they're the one-eyed statue versus the two-eyed statue. They can't see it. And that moment, I think, is also winked at the very end of the movie, because the last line of the movie says that she left symbols of her time on Earth, you know, for those that have two eyes open to see it.
They're visible only to those who know where to look.
Right. And so I think that is the movie talking to its own critics, in both in the good sense and the negative sense, because this movie puts you back in a mode of childlike reception, like what we said with Spirited Away,
right?
Which is, if you don't understand anything, you start to understand or participate in childhood in a similar way, because that's the mental mode of childhood, is without assumptions, only receiving.
The mode of childhood reminds me in this film and in Spirited Away of Bob Dylan's song Ballad of a Thin Man, the chorus of which goes, something is happening, but you don't know what it is. And that's exactly what happens in Spirited Away. It happens here too. And the beauty of the little girl there is that she doesn't really care what it is allegorically. She's like, oh, that should go on there. And that's how kids kind of see the world in a way, you know, totally different than the way the adults do.
But of course the writer and directors do. So it also reminded me of if this movie were a book by Henry James, it would be What Ophelia Knew, which is that the first part, it's all a character taking in everything without irony. But then the things that start to come from that person cause the adult world or the grown-up world or the world of assumptions to say, wait, what?
Right.
Because they're unsure. And there's something about letting the magic in that unsettles the adult world around Ophelia. At first, she's subject to it, and then it is subject to her, which is, of course, that's actually the parable, if you will, inside the movie.
That's her becoming the princess. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because that's exactly what I was going to say. Spoiler alert for part three, which I don't have to say now, which is that, you know, she leaves traces that are visible only to those who know where to look. And the two people, I think, that this movie shows you that know where to look are kids and artists.
And what's your moment?
I want to talk about when the captain has to sew up his own face. So as you remember, Mercedes kind of slices him in the mouth and cuts him, and he gets a scar, which, of course, it's impossible to watch this and not think of the Joker. Like, I ever tell you how I got these scars? You cannot think of that when you see it. But what do you make of that moment, and how would you respond to the charge that moment is gratuitous?
I would say that the thing about the captain, going back to what we were just talking about, vision and understanding, is that he is insensitive.
That's what I thought it was. Yeah. So I say, it's funny you said about being gratuitous, because you could easily watch the film and say, that's a very gratuitous moment. That's Del Toro kind of showing off. It's an unbelievable effect, but like, why am I being subjected to this? Cause it's rough to watch. Right. But I took it to be that the captain is one who has made friends with horror. Like Kurt says in Apocalypse Now, he is supped full with horrors, as Macbeth says. And that, you know, the movie's already established that, like when he kills the shepherd who he didn't have to kill and things like that, we already get that he's a bad dude and he has all his pliers out for his torture sessions. But I think that moment is something that shows you that, like, you know, the real monsters in the movie aren't necessarily the monsters in the fairy tale.
No, they're the people that are unfeeling.
Right.
In fact, the thing about Fairyland is it has all kinds of rules. That in Fairyland, everybody's sensitive to everything.
Right.
So you can offend people in Fairyland without understanding what you've given offense. But the adult monsters could literally put a needle in their own face and not feel it.
Yeah, the rules in Fairyland might be arbitrary, but at least the rules. Like, for example, when she goes to the Pale Man, remember what wakes him up? She eats the grapes. She eats two grapes. Right? You're not allowed to have. Now, why is that the rule? Because it's, I'm sure, and again, it's not an allegory. It's allegorical. Like, well, there's a giant feast and you're hungry. So it's about resisting temptation. And of course, why does she eat the grapes, not the giant piece of ham? Because she thinks as a kid, well, it's just like two little grapes. Like, no one's going to notice. But that's what happened. You broke the rules, right? So in the Fairyland, there are all these rules with consequences, and her feeling is terror because of what she's done. But the captain, he has no feelings.
Okay, welcome back. So in part three, of course, we always talk about the ending or the title or the key takeaways. There's a lot to discuss here. If people did not like this movie, other than because the Pale Man is scary, the reason that they don't like it is the ending. So Dan, I'm not going to ask you to defend the ending, but I just want you to explain it, because if you come in expecting Narnia, this does not end the way that you think it's going to end, or maybe it does. So
I think it does. I think it does.
What would you say?
I'm a little tired now of movies having to have cute, revelatory twist endings where the credits come on really quickly and then everyone in the audience goes, oh, and then people go and Google, like, what really happens at the end of No Country for Old Men? You know what I'm talking about? Like, that's a thing now. Like, your ending, and I'm all for dramatic endings, right? But like, to have your ending be like a little cute,
so abrupt.
Yeah, like really abrupt, like to come on and you're like, what? Like, what's that about? Right. That's kind of getting irritating, I think, in movies made today. I think this movie is an old Hollywood ending where you are sucker punched one time after another. It's totally emotional. I couldn't remember the last time a movie's ending hit me in the stomach as hard as this one did. And I'm a big baby when I watch movies. Like, I'm very emotional when I watch them. But I thought when the captain shoots her, and you think that is not supposed to happen. That does not happen. Now, of course, it happens in fairy tales all the time. The lead characters die all the time. The little girl doesn't always live. But in a big budget movie like this in 2006, that does not happen. And you find out that that's all part of the scheme, and that they shoot the captain with his broken watch, and his son's never going to know his name. And then you go to the fairy realm or whatever it is under the earth, and you see really what happened. And you're so, like, I was so joyful and so happy for what happened and how, like, she did it. Like, it was, the princess came back. That was really, really great. You know, there's also that element where she passed like the Willy Wonka test, because she wouldn't cut her little brother's let the blood spill, and that of course is what made it work. But I think at the ending's brilliant. I have more to say about that, but I want to hear your take.
No, I feel the same. I just that tends to be people's number one complaint is, okay, the ending was sad, which I don't necessarily think so. I actually think that there's something saccharine almost about the captain getting his comeuppance, but it's so unbelievably satisfying.
Yeah.
That you know, I think that's also why the stitching his own face up makes it work, because you don't want to believe that will triumph. And right. I think from an artistic perspective, the movie says insensitivity will never triumph.
Yeah. No, and if you don't feel moved at the end of this movie, then whatever. I don't know what to tell you. I really have no critical faculties to. It would be like explaining to someone, like, you know, why the Sistine Chapel is beautiful or something. Like, I don't know what to tell you. My other take about the ending was this. We mentioned Narnia before, but I think the work of literature that this movie most reminded me of is Don Quixote. Right. So in Don Quixote, he's a guy who gluts himself on books of chivalry to the point where he goes insane, and he starts to. His greatness is that he takes the best of what he reads and tries to enact them in real life. And everyone makes fun of him. The world makes fun of him. But the reader doesn't. The reader is sympathetic toward Quixote. If only we did live in a place full of valor and we weren't stuck in La Mancha or something like that. And it's the great thing about Don Quixote is you kind of like become what you read. And that's what he does. And here she does the same thing. Like, she is a reader of fairy tales, and she takes the best from the fairy tales, the best values, like pass a test, sacrifice yourself. You have to keep going on. You have to do the right thing. You have to do things you don't even understand why you're doing them. Like, put the mandrake root with the blood under the bed and the milk. but those are the best qualities of people in fairy tales, and she kind of lives them. And I think that's kind of that's what reminded me about this movie, how much it's like Don Quixote.
Yeah, it is just beautiful, and of course that is what artists do. Artists see things or take things in that they've read or they've seen, and they do make the world more like that, in the sense that maybe Del Toro can't affect reality, but he can give you something that you can participate in to then see with both eyes open. So there is some effect of reality there, that those people are a channel to something else.
Yeah,
in the world. And this is a beautiful movie. I'm not necessarily a big fan of his other stuff. This is just like one random breakthrough, but it's worth an entire corpus of some other people's work.
Well, this is your whole thing about how there are no directors, there are only movies, there are no authors, there are only books.
That is true.
We'll save that for another episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. We hope you've enjoyed our conversation about Pan's Labyrinth. You could follow us on X at 15minfilm. Please leave us a review wherever you can, wherever you get your podcast, whether it's on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We really appreciate those. You can let us know on X, or you can email us at 15minutefilms, spelled out, at Gmail. Give us requests. We always take requests. Also, you can follow us where, Mike?
Letterboxd.
Follow us on Letterboxd and let us know what we should watch. Keep the requests coming, and thank you so much for listening.
We'll see you next time.